Have you ever been in a spot in your life where you really wanted something that you couldn't have, but you wanted it bad? And in fact, almost to the point where you found it hard to be happy without that thing. Could be anything. Could be when you're a kid, it could be a toy. Could be a relationship. Could be a position, a recognition, possessions, money. You ever want something so bad you wish you could have it and you're not happy or consumed by it? And then, here's the question to follow up. Have you ever crossed that line where you found yourself doing something unethical because you had the power to make something happen, even if it wasn't exactly right, or even if it maybe took advantage of somebody else or hurt someone else, but it got you a chance to get what you wanted, and so that was a price you were willing to pay? Or has that ever happened to you? It's amazing how that our lusts and our desires, the things we covet, can so easily cross the line into greed. And when we have the power to exercise our greed, how dangerous that can be. And we're going to see that in today's story and how that plays out. So for today, we're taking a journey. If you've been with us for the past year and a quarter now, we've been taking a journey through the Bible, starting back last year in the beginning of the Old Testament or the Old Covenant, the Hebrew scriptures. We've been journeying through, and we found ourselves in the era of Israel's monarchy, where the nation had come together and had formed a kingdom eventually. And after a few kings, the kingdom was divided, and at that point in history, we began a little mini-series for a number of weeks that we're calling Thrones. And Thrones is the topic of the time that Israel, after King Solomon died, under his son's reign, the kingdom was divided into two. The northern kingdom became known as Israel. The southern kingdom became known as Judah. And they never again got back together. In fact, both kingdoms took different paths until they eventually both ceased to exist. And we're studying this era right now, and we're calling it Thrones. And we've been back and forth. Some weeks we're in the north, some weeks we're in the south. And for the past couple of our sermons on this topic, we've been in the north, and we saw how that the kingdom is now in its seventh king of the north. The first one was Jeroboam, and he had brought Israel away from their faith in God. He brought them away from, for political reasons, away from the God who they had served, the monotheistic creator of all things, the God of the universe, who led them out of slavery in Egypt and made it personal. He led them from that for political reasons to avoid the south and the temple down there. And in doing so, he led Israel away from their faith. And all the kings of the north have not been spiritually healthy. But the worst one is the seventh one that we've been studying the last couple of weeks. His name was Ahab. And Ahab was a different kind of messed up. In fact, he married a woman who was a king's daughter. Her name was Jezebel. She was the daughter of a king from another country, and she was a force to be reckoned with. And when Jezebel came to and Ahab married her, she brought with her some of the worst and most ancient forms of idolatrous religion that had been around since the Israelites were coming out of slavery in Egypt. It's been around for a while, and we've discussed it before. It's Baal worship. It's Asherah worship. And these religions were terrible in their practices. We've talked about it before. We won't go into that today. But she brought that into the northern kingdom. So not only has the northern kingdom been pulled away from their faith in God to some extent, but now they've been pulled into some terrible, terrible moral practices and how they treated the other people, what they did in the name of their religion. And that was Ahab and Jezebel, this power couple. They were a power couple in all the worst possible ways. And during this time, God raised up a prophet named Elijah. Not just Elijah, he was the most notable one, but other prophets as well. And it was a time when the nation needed a spiritual voice more than ever. So at one point, we saw a couple weeks ago that Elijah showed up and told Israel and told the king, Ahab, that a drought was going to come to the land, followed by a famine, followed from the drought, which would also cause an economic downturn. And that whole economic downturn was God's attempt to get the nation's attention to know that he was still God and he was still there, though they've walked away, but he wanted a relationship with them. Before Elijah was done, a few years passed, and it climaxed with an epic showdown on Mount Carmel, And Ahab was there. The prophets of Baal were there. Elijah was there. The people of the nation gathered, as many as could locally do so, and they saw God's power so clearly that the people of Israel finally saw that the God of Israel was not just a story from their ancestors, but he was powerful in their lives. And the people said, "The Lord, he is God." Yes, the Lord is God. And that was the whole point. God was trying to bring them back. But he was also trying to bring back Ahab, and Ahab was not interested. Even after all God did, Ahab did not care. Him and Jezebel just doubled down together on killing the prophets of God, on continuing their reign of wickedness and terror. And God is not done trying to get a hold of Ahab still. And that brings us into the two stories that we'll see today together, the first one and then one more. Starting with 1 Kings chapter 20 and beginning with verse 1. It says, "About that time, King Ben-Hadad of Aram mobilized his army, supported by the chariots and the horses of 32 allied kings, and they went to besiege Samaria, the capital of Israel, and they launched attacks against it." Now, interesting thing here is that King Ben-Hadad is coming with other kingdoms. There's an alliance going on here. He's the big dog. He's the main one. And all these other kings are sort of beholden to him. He's the power player. It's kind of like there's alliances globally today, right? You think of groups like NATO and other things like that, where nations form a treaty and an alliance, and they work together in a promise of being serving each other's best interests and taking care of each other in times of war or times of need. That's just kind of the same idea. There's usually a big player, like the United States would be probably in NATO today. Well, in this time, Ben-Hadad's the big nation. Aram's the big powerful nation, and these other kings were in an alliance with him. So they were asked to join him because he wanted to take over the northern kingdom. He wanted to conquer Samaria. Why? Because he's greedy. Because he didn't have enough. He wanted more. He was powerful. He was rich. He had a large kingdom. But he brings these men with him to conquer Samaria. And Samaria's in trouble. Verse 2 tells us, "Ben-Hadad sent messengers into the city to relay this message to King Ahab of Israel. This is what Ben-Hadad says." Verse 3, "Your silver and your gold are mine, and so are your wives and the best of your children." So here's what he came for. He shows up with a force and says, "Listen, we can crush you. So here's what I want from you. All your silver and your gold that you've enjoyed, that you've had to live off, now belongs to me. All your wives that you've enjoyed are now mine to take and enjoy. And also the best of your children." It's funny, he doesn't say all your children. He says also the best of your children. Apparently he didn't want certain of the kids. You can keep those ones, okay? I don't know if you've ever, you know, raised a couple few kids and you're like, you know, you understand what he's saying right here. Like if someone came by to take your kid, you know, "Take this one, please." "No, really, I think you should take this one." I want your silver, your gold, I want your wives, and I want the best of your children, okay? That was his deal. Now that's pretty serious. That's when you want to fight back. But what do you do? King Ben-Hadad is like that bully in school who comes to the kid and twists his arm and says, "Give me your lunch money or else I'll hurt you." And, "Okay, fine, just don't hurt me. Take my money." You know? So what's Ahab going to do? This powerful force, this alliance of kings is out there. The kings would set up tents outside of cities they would conquer, far from the battlefield, so they're out of harm's way, and watch their generals go to war while they feasted inside of tents. And Ben-Hadad's there, and these other kings, who some of them came with him, are there. And so he says, "Give me your silver, your gold, your wives, your children, now." And they're powerless. So verse 4, "All right, my lord the king," Israel's king replied, "all that I have is yours. You can take it. I don't want to die. You can have it. You can have my family. You can have my wealth." Well, what does a bully do when a bully gets their way? The problem with a bully is when you give them their way, they want to keep coming back. Like, "Oh, that was easy. I'm going to keep coming back and pushing that button. I want lunch money tomorrow too," right? So at some point, the problem with a bully is you got to stand up to them, but that could cost you something. That's why no one wants to do it. But even if it costs you something, it's worth it at some point because you get to the point where enough is enough, right? Enough's enough. So, but Ben-Hadad, he says, oh, you'll give me all that? Well, I'm greedy. I'm here to get more wealth for myself. And that was easy. So I'm going to raise the stakes even higher. Verse number 5, soon Ben-Hadad's messengers returned again. And they said, this is what Ben-Hadad says. I've already demanded your silver, that you give me your silver, your gold, your wives, and your children. But about this time tomorrow, I'll send my officials to search your palace and the homes of your officials, and they will take away everything that you consider valuable. So here's what he says. I'm going to send my guys. We're going to go. And boy, that's an invasion of pride. It's like, whoa, you're going to come in here? I already said I'd send my money out to you to pay you to go away. But you're going to come in. Do you have a search warrant for that? I mean, I don't want you walking in my property, pilfering through my closets and my stuff. Oh, no, I'm sending my guys into your house. We're going to go through everything you have. And if it's valuable to you, we're taking that too. And now Ahab decides, for some reason, taking his gold and silver and wives and kids wasn't worth standing up against, or wasn't worth the impossibility of it. But now he says, I draw the line there. So in verse 7, it says, then Ahab summoned all the elders of the land and said to them, look how this man is stirring up trouble. I already agreed with his demand that I give him my wives and children and silver and gold. Verse 8, don't give in to any more demands, all the elders and the people advised. Let's draw the line here. He just can't come into our property and walk through and take what he wants. We draw the line here. We'll stand up. So Ahab, verse 9, Ahab told the messengers from Ben-Hadad, say this to my lord the king. I will give you everything you asked for the first time, but I cannot accept this last demand of yours. So the messengers returned to Ben-Hadad with that response. Of course, that's not going to go over well. Look how the intimidating answer. Look what happens in verse 10. Then Ben-Hadad sent this message to Ahab, may the gods strike me and even kill me if there remains enough dust from Samaria to provide even a handful for each of my soldiers. Now, if you don't understand what that's saying, let me try to explain it to you best I can here. So what he's saying is this. We're so strong, we're about to pulverize your city and decimate your everybody. And when we're done, we're so big and strong that we're going to survive in such huge numbers that my surviving soldiers from the conflict will be so many still that when we pick up the dust of what's left of your city by the handful, there won't even be enough handfuls for all my soldiers to hold a handful of the dust of your city. In other words, you can't possibly win, and we're way too strong for you. It's just an intimidating threat. But I kind of love Ahab's response, if you look at it. In verse number 11, the king of Israel sent this answer. He said, a warrior putting on his sword for battle should not boast like a warrior who has already won. He's like, okay, you ain't won yet, buddy. I said, you talk a big game. You're talking some smack in the press before the game, but maybe you should show up on the court and produce first. You know, he's just saying, I hear you talking, but you ain't done it yet. Verse 12, Ahab's reply reached Ben-Hadad and the other kings as they were drinking in their tents. Prepare to attack. Ben-Hadad commanded his officers, so they prepared to attack the city. And now the inevitable is going to come. A powerful alliance of kings under Ben-Hadad are going to roll down and destroy a city because they want their wealth. Nothing they can do. It's the end. You say your prayers, say your goodbyes, do your thing, whatever you're going to do. But about this time, God decides he's going to step in. Verse 13, then a certain prophet came to see King Ahab. Verse 13 here, here we are. Notice what he says here. Notice that phrase, a certain prophet. A certain prophet, that's powerful. Because Elijah, we saw the last couple of weeks, thought, I'm the only one left. Even though he knew he wasn't, he was convinced he was the only one left. And God kept saying, Elijah, there are many more. And now, sure enough, a certain prophet shows up to Ahab and told him, this is what the Lord says. Do you see all the enemy forces? Today I will hand them over to you, all of them. And then you will know that I am the Lord. Now that's remarkable. That is truly remarkable. Because there's no way Israel can stand against this force. But God says, you can with me. It's like when the big brother shows up to meet the bully in the playground, you know? God says, I got this. He will not win. And I'm gonna hang on that verse for a minute because I want to tell you what happens, but I want to come back to it. What happens next without reading the story is a battle takes place. Now, I know some of you love the battles. Some of you love the adventures. Some of you, probably more guys than girls being stereotypical, if I can do that. Probably when you watch action movies, you might actually want to watch the battle scenes the most and fast forward the boring dialogue, right, or whatever. We're going to skip the battle scenes here. I'm so sorry to tell you that. But you can read them for yourself. They're in this chapter and following. But anyhow, basically what happens is Israel wins. King Ben-Hadad and his forces lose bad somehow. And they go back licking their wounds and humiliated. And the prophet of God says to King Ahab, they'll be back. His pride won't let him. He'll be back in about a year. Get ready for it again. So be prepared. And sure enough, a year later, Ben-Hadad says, you know what? We lost that battle because they were fighting on, they had their local gods. He was superstitious. They have their local gods that are good on that kind of terrain because these local gods are good in certain kind of environments. But we'll fight them on a different plane, and they'll lose that battle. So they came with a new plan, but God once again stepped in, and Israel for the second time whooped Ben-Hadad's forces. In fact, this has nothing to do with today's story, but for those of you who like to nerd out on the history part of it, just a quick thought for you. This is the beginning of the end for King Ben-Hadad of Aram. Because after he loses these two fights, he is so weakened that within a few years, one of his own assistants, one of his own leaders in his cabinet will execute him and take over his throne. He never recovers personally from this defeat. And Israel is spared what should have been a trouncing from a big bully. But they won. And notice that last part of the phrase there on the screen. Notice that then the prophet said to Ahab, I'm going to give you the victory, and then you will know that I am the Lord. You see what God's doing, folks? God is still trying to reach King Ahab. All that he had done through Elijah, and the people of the land were starting to say, okay, the Lord is God, the Lord is God. But Ahab was stubborn. He wasn't seeing it. And God, he said, look, I'm going to give you some victory. And then you're going to know. He still wants Ahab. And here's the thing. He was trying hard. I don't understand sometimes. You think that God might have washed his hands of Ahab at this point. I mean, he could have done what other people have done, and God's done in the previous stories and said, you know what? You don't want me? Enjoy the world and the harshness of it without me, and experience the loss of battle and the death of your family, because that's what happens to kings and kingdoms in that part of the world. God could have stepped back to Ahab like he did other people and just let them suffer the realities of life. But God is still stepping up to show Ahab that he's the Lord. Of all people, why Ahab? Why would God care about that? He's the worst of them all. It's almost a good reminder to you that if you ever feel you've gotten to a place in your life where you're so far away from who you should be and where you should be, or so far from God, or maybe you've gone too far, that you have. And if you're hearing a message like this, you're hearing God say to your heart, I'm not giving up on you yet. I'm still pursuing you. There might come a spot where we just do something that we cross the line. But God is so patient. If you're hearing this today, God's saying, I'm not giving up on you. It's not too late. Listen carefully. And if you know somebody in your life that you think, oh, that person's unredeemable, God's pretty patient and pretty aggressive with reaching the hard cases. And he's trying to get Ahab's attention. He spares them two times from being destroyed and losing all his life, or at least his wealth and his family. But does Ahab learn? Does Ahab come to faith in the end? No, he does not. In the end, Ahab learns nothing. In fact, what happens next is a tragic story because of that. Let's tell that story now. Chapter 21, verse 1. Now there was a man named Naboth from Jezreel who owned a vineyard in Jezreel beside the palace of King Ahab of Samaria. So, little context, remember that Ahab's father, we saw this several weeks ago, Ahab's father moved the kingdom of the north to the land of Samaria and built the royal city there and built his palace right next to this vineyard, we find out now, that belonged to this guy named Naboth's family. So his, all of a sudden, he's got this vineyard, and then right next to him, the new palace has been built about a generation ago. And so that's kind of convenient for the king. And so in verse 2, it says, one day Ahab said to Naboth, you know, since your vineyard is so convenient to my palace, I would like to buy it and use it as a vegetable garden. I will give you a better vineyard in exchange, or if you prefer, I will pay you for it. So here's Ahab's whole sales pitch. Look, I want that vineyard because of its proximity to my house, my palace. There are better properties elsewhere, but have you ever been in a spot where you had an empty lot next to your property and you wanted to buy the empty lot because it make your own property bigger or keep unwanted people away? I don't know why, but Ahab's like, I want this vineyard because it's against my property. It's a great piece of land for me to own. So hey, Naboth, if you'll sell it to me, I'll give you a better one. Who wouldn't want a better property? Or I'll pay you well for it. As the king comes on good terms. He just says, look, I just want to buy it from you. And he offers him a deal. Verse 3, but Naboth replied, the Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance that was passed down by my ancestors. Naboth says, I'm not selling. Now, I'm going to say something for a couple minutes here that almost a little of a detour from the story that maybe most of you don't need to hear, but some of you, I was raised in a very religious culture where Naboth is heralded for this statement as being some kind of a superstar man of faith. He said, the Lord forbid I'll give my inheritance to... It's a great preachy point when you're trying to preach to people about, you know, don't change. He's really idolized for what he says right here. I know nothing about Naboth. There's no guarantee he was a man of any kind of faith at all. He was just a man who owned some land who didn't want to sell it. He wanted to keep it in the family. That's all we know, okay? Now, it was not uncommon at this point. I know that land, ancestral land was important, but at this point in Israel's history, lots of folks have been selling their ancestral land for a long time. Ever since the Israelites arrived into the land of Canaan and settled down, and land was given to them by their tribes and by families, for the generations that followed, they would sell that property. In fact, at the beginning of this Thrones series we're doing, when the kingdom divided into two, lots of people sold their land and moved. For example, down south, a lot of the tribe of Simeon sold their land from their ancestors, and they moved up north to the northern kingdom to get out of the high taxes of the south. You ever know somebody who moved to a different place or country or state to evade high taxation where they used to live? People moved out of the south to the northern kingdom to get out of the high taxes of the southern kingdom. Or some people from the north moved to the south once the kingdom divided, because they wanted to be close to the temple for spiritual reasons. And some people moved from one side to the other for political reasons. So selling your land was not uncommon anymore like it was early on. And some people are, you know, free spirits. I mean, just sell something and go having a new adventure. And others are very, like, homebodies and sentimental. And Naboth is in that category. Like, this is a generational heirloom. I mean, this is an heirloom, but, you know, property. I care about this property. I don't care if it's nicer property. I'm content where I am, and I don't want to sell what means something to my family's, you know, history. It doesn't mean he was a righteous man. It just means that was his personality. And he did not want to sell this land to the king. That was his prerogative. He had every right to say no, and the king offered to buy it, and he said no. So that should be the end of the story, right? But it's not the end of the story. It says in verse 4, so Ahab went home angry and sullen because of Naboth's answer. So he took the answer, but he didn't like it. He did what, you know, so it says the king went to bed with his face to the wall and refused to eat. Now, I'm sorry, I don't want to, you know, be this way, but it's really hard to look at Ahab in a very high regard when he's being all pouty like this, okay? It just seems so pathetic, doesn't it? It really does. I mean, he's like your kids when you tell your child, you know, no, you can't go to that party, or no, you can't do that thing you want to do or whatever, and they're like all sulky all day. Ahab, like, at least he accepts the bad news to Naboth's face, but then he goes home and he's like all bummed out. He's pouting and he's sullen and upset. He goes to bed and lays against the wall and refuses to eat. It's time to eat. I'm not hungry. So weird. So someone sends his wife to him. So verse 5, what's the matter? His wife Jezebel asked him. What made you so upset that you're not eating? What's the matter with my widow Mansy, huh? Someone hurt your widow feelings? What's wrong with you? Why won't you eat? She says. And he tells her, he says in verse number 6, I asked Naboth to sell me his vineyard or trade it, but he refused. Ahab told her. Look what she says. Are you the king of Israel or not? Jezebel demanded. Get up and eat something and don't worry about it. I'll get you Naboth's vineyard. Hey, are you all sad? You get up and get some foodie in your little tummy, okay? And mama's going to take care of it for you. Don't you worry about it, okay? You get yourself some Gerbers, and I'm going to go get that vineyard, okay? So he does, and she takes care of it, all right. Check out verse 8. So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent them to the elders and other leaders of the town where Naboth lived. In her letters, she commanded, call the citizens together for a time of fasting. Give Naboth a place of honor. The idea here is, a time of fasting means something's wrong. We got to seek out what's wrong for whatever reason. Get them together for a time of fasting. And then put Naboth in a prominent spot in the middle of this gathering. And then, verse 10, seat two scoundrels across from him who will accuse him of cursing God and the king. And then take him out and stone him to death. Folks, that's brutal. Like accuse him falsely. And once you accuse him, drag him out of the city and just believe the false testimony. Drag him out of the city. Stoning is brutal. I mean, to take someone out there and pick up rocks and stones and throw that at somebody until you kill them, until they die from broken bones and injuries and concussions and blood bleeding out. I mean, it's brutal. And that's her orders in the king's name. And here's the thing. The town may not have wanted to do it, perhaps, but no one told Jezebel. No, if you saw the last couple of weeks, you know this was a fearsome king and a fearsome queen, a very fearsome couple. It's a power couple. And they said, do something. You just did it because otherwise you're next. And so she says, do it. And sure enough, verse 11, so the elders and the other town leaders, followed the instructions Jezebel had written in the letters. They called for a fast. Verse 11, they put Naboth at a prominent place before the people. And then in verse 13, the two scoundrels came and sat down across from him. And they accused Naboth before all the people, saying he cursed God and he cursed the king. So he was dragged outside of the town and stoned to death. Can you imagine this? False accusation, false witnesses, a judge, jury type of situation of people saying, oh, we believe that. In front of the whole town, everyone he knew, he's accused and then he's condemned and then he's dragged. Can you imagine what he's thinking? He's dragged outside the city? Like, wait, no, guys, what's this whole thing? What is all this about? I didn't do any of that stuff. What are you doing? As he's being tossed outside and getting ready to be stoned or being stoned, does it cross his mind why it's happening? Does he ever figure out he was set up and taken out of the picture because he was in the way? Then the town leaders, in verse 14, the town leaders sent word to Jezebel, Naboth has been stoned to death. Oh, what do you know? He suicided himself, right? What do you know? He's not here anymore. He's not a problem. As Naboth's gone. They tell her. When Jezebel heard the news, she said to Ahab, hey, you know that vineyard of Naboth wouldn't sell you? Well, you can have it now. He's dead. Now, Ahab had to know what she was going to do, right? When she told him to go get some cereal while she took care of it, he had to know. He had to know that their tactics were always brutal. He had to know that he was going to do some kind of a pain point infliction on this guy. At least, you know, maybe, you know, their cousin Vinny would show up and just, you know, break a few fingers, or maybe he would die. I mean, they have a history here. Or he had to know. So when she comes and says, oh, he's dead now. Yeah, I don't know. Found him dead. Shot himself in the back of the head or something. I don't know what happened. He's gone. Ahab knew. He knew. He knew what happened. But what does he do about it? Well, he smiles. Puts on his big boy pants. And it says in verse 16, he went immediately down to the vineyard of Naboth to claim it. He shows up to claim eminent domain. Think about this. So that no one else can claim it. So Naboth's family can't claim it. He just says, hey, It's mine now. It's brutal. Folks, this is just a glimpse into the darkness of Ahab and Jezebel's legacy. Just a glimpse. We can't tell in a series like we're doing on Sundays all the stories. In fact, all the stories aren't even in the scripture. This is just a glimpse into how messed up. This was a couple who blatantly abused their power as king and as queen. And I want to make a statement to you and just take a moment here before we finish the story in a few minutes. But here's what I want to say. Hey, don't abuse grace by abusing others. Don't abuse grace by abusing others. Here's the thing. Ahab had experienced remarkable grace when the king of Aram showed up with his forces to crush him or take all his stuff, and he had the power to do it. Ben-Hadad had the power to take everything Ahab cared about and kill Ahab or leave him with nothing. And he was terrified. And God stepped in and said, Ahab, I want you to see one more time. I want you to see that I'm God. And Ahab was redeemed, was rescued from that, but he did not embrace that grace. Instead, he abused it. He abused that grace by abusing others. That's what we do, by the way. Whenever in our lives we're tempted to do something, you and me, don't point fingers, this is for you and me, when we're tempted to do something that helps what we want happen, helps my outcome work out, helps me get what I want, helps me get ahead, helps me win, at the expense of somebody else, is an abuse of grace. It's saying that all that God has done for me is not enough. I don't even think about it because I want this thing so bad that I'm going to focus on it and even maybe do something wrong because I need it and I must have it. And when we abuse others, we're basically saying, well, God says not enough, so I'll hurt somebody else he loves to get what I feel I need. Never abuse grace by abusing others, but Ahab has done so, Jezebel has done so. And God had done so much for them, so much. He has just done to Naboth exactly what Ben-Hadad came to do to him. He had been on both sides of this thing and experienced the reminder the first time that God could step in, trying to get Ahab's heart. And now he turned around and from the position of his own power and strength said, I can take what I want from somebody else. The problem is he forgot about God. Verse 17 says, but the Lord said to Elijah, go down to meet King Ahab of Israel, who rules in Samaria. He will be at Naboth's vineyard in Jezreel, claiming it for himself. Give him this message. This is what the Lord says. Wasn't it enough that you killed Naboth? Must you rob him too? In other words, there's two terrible, honestly, two capital offenses here, historically. Stealing from somebody and murdering, both the capital. You've done both. You have killed this man. You've stolen property from his family, claimed it for yourself. By the way, isn't that terrible? Isn't our fear? He's the king. Does anyone here like the thought of a local or national or federal government or local government coming in and having the power to say, we can take your property from you, and if you don't accept, we'll just take it from you and harm you anyhow? I mean, that's everyone's worst fear. Like, this is mine, you know? What are you doing? And Ahab has done both of those things. He's taken this property. Him and Jezebel had Naboth murdered. And God says, because you have done this, dogs will lick your blood at the very place where they licked the blood of Naboth. At the spot where Naboth was stoned to death and died, and they took his body and buried him somewhere, and the dogs came by and licked the pool of blood that was left behind. That's the very spot. I'm telling you, you're going to die. That was a cat. You're going to pay for what you just did. Here's the sentence from God. You're going to die in that very same place the dog's going to lick your blood to. It's pretty powerful. So Elijah shows up. It says in verse 20, look at what Ahab says. So my enemy, you have found me. Ahab is always so dramatic. If you were with us a couple weeks ago when he first met Elijah and Elijah had the drought thing going on, you know, Ahab's words were, oh, it's you who's causing trouble in Israel. And Elijah's like, no, I'm the one causing trouble in Israel. You are. What's wrong? You know, you're the problem. So Ahab's doing it again. Oh, my enemy, you have found me. He's always dramatic with prophets of God. If he couldn't kill them, he was dramatic with them. In fact, you'll see in our next story that Elijah, that Ahab with another prophet before he dies is the same kind of personality. But he says, you found me, my enemy. Look what Elijah responds. Yes, Elijah answered, I have come because you have sold yourself to do what is evil in the Lord's sight. So now, verse 21, now the Lord says, I will bring disaster on you and consume you. And Elijah proceeds to tell him this whole thing we read earlier. The dog's going to lick your blood right where they licked the blood of the man you killed to seize his property. Is coming. Your days are coming, buddy. But not just him. In fact, in verse 23, it says, and regarding Jezebel, the Lord says, dogs will eat Jezebel's body at the plot of land in Jezreel. So she's going to get hers too. Guys, they're both going down for that. Like, why does God care? It's just one guy. I mean, people die all the time in these wars and kingdoms and battles. Why does God care for just one guy, Naboth? But that's the point, isn't it? That God cares about the individual. That God cares about you. That God cares about the people that you treat or mistreat, or I treat or mistreat. That individuals matter to God. And so God says, Ahab, you're going to die. Here's how. Jezebel's going to die. It's going to be bad. It's going to be ugly. Verse 24, he says, the members of Ahab's family who die in the city will be eaten by dogs. Wow. And those who die in the field will be eaten by the vultures. He says, basically what he's saying is what's going to happen to Ahab's family is what has happened to at least three kingdoms in Israel, in the northern kingdom, since the kingdom was divided before Ahab. This will be the third time that someone comes in and kills the king, destroys the royal family terribly, and takes over the throne. And God is telling Ahab, it's happening to you and your family now. Now, again, I've already said this, but I want you to see the Bible. I want you to see the scripture say what I've been saying, verse 25. Verse 25 says this, no one else, this is so powerful, no one else so completely sold himself to do what was evil in the Lord's sight as Ahab did under the influence of his wife Jezebel. That's a powerful statement. That's what we've been trying to say in these stories. That's what this story just now is supposed to paint a picture of abuse of power and evil. Just to give us one more glimpse into the earlier glimpses and the later glimpses to come of how terrible. But here's the summary. No one else so completely sold himself to do what was evil in the Lord's sight as Ahab did under the influence of his wife, Jezebel. Verse 26 says his worst outrage was worshiping idols, just as the Amorites had done. The people for whom the Lord had driven out from the land ahead of the Israelites. Now, if you're looking at that, you might be thinking, that's the worst outrage, worshiping idols? I think the worst outrage was killing somebody and stealing his land or killing a bunch of prophets. How's that his worst outrage? Don't misread what it's saying here. What it's saying is this. This was the big sin that led to all the others. This was the big domino that caused everything else to fall. In other words, when Ahab rejected God, he rejected God's ways. I say all the time, when we follow God, we follow God's best practices. And God who made us, made this world, has best practices for us. And when we reject God, we reject his ways. We reject his best practices. And when Ahab has rejected God, he's walked away from God's ways. And he's followed in the ways of these Amorite idols we mentioned, like Baal and Ashtaroth. Were full of very vulgar, self-serving, terrible practices. He had no moral compass because he had no relationship with God who would have given him one. And that decision to reject God led to all the other things in his life that caused him to do the things that we find so terrible. Now, last couple of verses and we'll be done in a moment. Verse 27 says, but when Ahab heard this message, he tore his clothing, he dressed in burlap, and he fasted. He even slept in burlap and went about in deep mourning. Now, this is kind of a good moment for him, although, to be honest, I'm having a hard time giving him the credit he deserves for this after his last pouty session in the bed. But I got to give him some props for this, okay, just for a moment here. Because Ahab literally tears off his royal clothing. Look, how a person dresses, that's a statement, especially people in power. and wealth. Like, look at my clothes. I'm somebody. I'm the king. Look at my royal apparel. He takes it off and he puts on burlap. It's a sign of humiliation. It's a sign of humbling himself. He walks around like, don't dress like that. What are you? You're the king. And he dresses that way and he sleeps that way and he shows his deep sorrow and humility over the pronounced judgment upon him and his family. And because he does this, God sends another message to Elijah. I don't know that Elijah, doesn't say Elijah told Ahab this next message, but God tells Elijah in verse number 28, another message from the Lord came to Elijah. Do you see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has done this, I will not do what I promised during his lifetime. It will happen to his sons. I will destroy his dynasty. So you're like, God says, I told him he's still going to die. The dogs are going to still lick his blood where they licked Naboth's blood. Jezebel's still going to die. But I was going to let them all get wiped out with a hostile takeover. I'll go ahead and let him die on his own that way and not have to live to see his whole family go through that because of his humility here. But it's still going to happen. He's still going to pay for what he did. I'll let the worst things happen in his son's administration. You're like, well, that's not fair to the son, is it? Oh, no. You haven't met the kids. Ahab and Jezebel, they raised the kids. Well, the family resemblance was striking. They were a whole terrible bunch. You'll see. It goes beyond this kingdom. In fact, their story is it goes beyond into the other kingdom. This family is just a messed up people. Like, the world is better off without. I mean, this is a messed up group. And so God says, I'll let Ahab die like he's going to, and Jezebel will die, but I'll let his family will happen after he's gone, when his son brings his own judgment on his own head. And that's the end of the story for today. What a sad ending. Like, the story today was a king who was overpowered by a bully who wanted to take all his stuff because he wanted more, and he's scared, and God stepped in and said, I'll take you through it to show you that I'm real, that I'm God, and I want a relationship with you. And he takes that grace, and instead of embracing it, he abuses it by abusing others, by saying, that's nice, but I want more for myself. That's nice, but I want this guy's stuff. I'm going to take what he has. I'll do the same thing to him that this other guy tried to do to me. I'll kill him, and I'll take his land because I want it for myself, and I can, so I will. What a sad story. And it marks the ending. By the way, we're at the ending of Ahab's life. Next week, we will have a battle to talk about, and we will see the end of Ahab's life. In fact, next week we're going to call that lesson next week, Kill Shot. Okay? You'll understand that next week. But for today, let me leave you with one simple thought, and that is this. Greed kills. Greed kills. And we saw it in the story today. We saw it in the story today. That Ben-Hadad's greed to come almost killed Ahab and his whole capital city and his family, if God hadn't stopped that. But Ahab, as the king of Israel, rejected that and turned around in his own greed, and he and Jezebel literally killed Naboth. But not only did it kill Naboth, but eventually their greed would kill Ahab. Ahab would die for his greed. Jezebel would die for her greed. Greed kills. And it has through history. Lots of people are dead today because of greed. All across the world. Today, in our very weekend we're living in right now, across the world and before, wars have broken out because you trace it all the way back to different people, and there's fingers to be pointed in all directions because of greed. Greed kills. And it has, and it still does, locally and in towns and families and neighborhoods and communities. Greed kills. But greed doesn't only kill people. Greed doesn't only kill people. Greed can kill your joy. How many of you ever couldn't be happy? I asked you that at the beginning. You couldn't be happy because you wanted something so bad that you couldn't have. So bad that you don't even think about all the blessings. Folks, I want to remind us all, I say this so often, we are rich, we are blessed. I know that you might not be as wealthy as someone sitting nearby you, or maybe you're the poorest person in the room by comparison here or in the community even. But globally, we are the wealthiest. We are amongst the most blessed people in the world. We are upper percentage people in the world's population for wealth and blessing and peace and prosperity. But sometimes we look at all of that grace and we say, yeah, but that's not enough. I have to have this too. I got to have that toy as a child, or I got to have that relationship, or I got to have that position, or that promotion, or that recognition, or that possession, or that money. And it's something I got to have. And if I don't have that, I can't be happy. And greed will not just kill people. Greed kills joy. It leaves us in a spot where we're always saying, if I only had that, then I'd be happy. And it can eventually lead us to crossing ethical boundaries to get what we want. Because greed kills. It kills people. It kills joy. You know what it kills? It kills relationships. Many people's relationships through history have been damaged. Many lives have been damaged between people, between friends, between family, relationally, because of greed. So here's what I want you to do today as we get ready to go home. I want to ask you, how do we stop it from getting there? How do we stop it from getting there? How do we stop ourselves from crossing a line? I know we may not kill someone, but how can we not let greed, and the power that we have, we all have power, don't we? Don't we? Come on now. We all have the power. If you're on your feet today, if you're awake, if you have a mind and you have a body that functions and you have a little bit of influence at all, there's times we can just kind of get our way to get what we want, even if it costs someone else something. Be careful about greed. How do we stop that from happening? I think we step back and we realize, if I can't have that or don't have that, I'm okay without it. That God has been so good to me, I'm going to embrace the grace I've received rather than abusing it. I'm going to be content with what I have and let it go before it destroys and consumes me and robs me of my ability to enjoy life. Because greed kills. We'll finish Ahab's arc next week. It's going to be a wild one.